Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this afternoon session of our conference of the LSE Conference on Citizen Basic Income. The event is part of the LSE Festival Beverage 2.0, which is taking place from the 19th to the 24th of February, which is this next Saturday, and it's part of a whole year of activities here at LSE on rethinking the future of the welfare state for the 21st century and for the global context. My name is Angelita Tahirai, and I am visiting senior fellow here at LISI, European Institute at the LSE, and also one of the organizers for this event. We are very grateful to supporters and organizers of this event, as you can see from the logos there, we have found great spirit of collaboration within LSE departments and beyond. So in particular, I would like to thank LISI, European Institute, Stickert, International Development Department, Social Policy Department, the United Nations Development Programme, and CBIT, Citizen Basic Income Trust. I am very pleased to chair this session, in particular because it brings together, for the first time at an academic setting, speakers from the basic income experiments around the world. I'd like to ask you to put your phones on silent. The event is being hopefully recorded, and you'll be made available as a podcast. For the Twitter users in the audience, the hashtags to be used are LSE Beverage and LSE Festival. As well as being interested to hear about the experiments from our speakers, we are also interested to hear from you. So we would like to know how your views have changed throughout the day following the presentations that you have attended in the morning and afternoon session. So before we start with the presentations, my colleague and also co-organizer of this event, Dr. Malcolm Torrey, who is visiting senior fellow at the Social Policy Department here at the LSE and also director of the Citizen Basic Income Trust, will briefly explain an experiment that you are all invited to join. Malcolm?
Thank you. Those of you who were here this morning, this will be a familiar sight, these exercise sheets. For those of you who've come just this afternoon, a new experience. I'd like to thank Kate Summers of the Social Policy Department for suggesting that we conduct such experiments when people are gathered together, because such exercises were interesting and useful at last year's LSE Festival. Inside your programme, you will find a sheet of paper that says a participative exercise for the afternoon session of the LSE Citizens Basic Income Day. A citizen's basic income, also known as a basic income, a citizen's income, a universal basic income, is an unconditional, non-withdrawable income paid to every individual. You'll find that written at the top of the sheet. You're going to listen to a variety of presentations this afternoon. As you listen to them, in the second and subsequent columns of the sheet that you've got in your hands, you're going to evaluate those different projects. So, down the left-hand side of the sheet, I would like you, if you wish, this is a voluntary exercise, of course, entirely up to you. If you wish, then please list what you think are the conditions that would need to be fulfilled for an experiment to be counted as a genuine citizens' basic income pilot project. So that's down the left-hand column. I'd then like you to put in the subsequent columns a tick where that particular experiment fulfills what you believe to be those conditions. So you may do that during the afternoon and during the break, and then we'll come back to that exercise right at the end of the afternoon. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Malcolm. Thank you, Malcolm. We have an amazing panel of speakers lined up for you today, and I'm very pleased to welcome all of our speakers for the afternoon session. Their bios are all in the program that you have received. Therefore, as we have a lot to get on and the time is short, I will simply introduce their names and the title of their presentations. However, I'll only introduce the first speaker. We have a change in the program. We will have the first speaker, who is Professor Olli Kangas from the Social Insurance Institution of Finland, will be talking on implementing a basic income experiment in a complex welfare state system, the case of Finland. Olli will be talking for 10 minutes, and then you'll have a chance for 5 minutes to ask him questions as he has to leave early. And then we'll continue with the rest of the presentations. Thank you. Olli.
Thank you for inviting me to present our humble experiment and to say something about it. First, some clarifications. First, this is not a proper basic income, and especially it's not a proper citizen basic income, because in Finland everything is not citizen-based but residence-based. If it's something, in that case it's a residence basic income, but it's not a basic income experiment, and you will see a little bit later why I'm saying that it's not the proper experiment with the proper basic income scheme. I will say something about why this kind of thing was started in Finland, and then I will tell about those problems that I as a leader and we as a research group had with planning this kind of experiment and implementing it in reality. And then I will say something what the experiment is about and how it is functioning just now. First, the center-right government wanted to have an experiment with basic income to eliminate incentive traps. In Finland, we have lots of, not means-tested, but income income-tested benefits that are paid on top of each other. And then it leads to a situation when marginal tax rates can be 80%, even higher, in some cases, or 100%. And therefore, work incentives are very weak, and work doesn't pay. And then there are lots of bureaucratic traps, because the system is very complicated, and not even me, as a social security bureaucrat, I don't know how the system is functioning, not to speak about those clients that are there in the middle of the jungle, or social, different kind of social benefits. So that was the background. And then, of course, those challenges that are taking place in the labor markets, the motivation, what the fourth industrial revolution is causing in our employment sector, and therefore the old social security that we had in the industrial period, it's not that relevant anymore, perhaps. The government reserved 20 million for the experiment, and then there was a competition on the money that was research for planning the experiment, and then our team, or my team, unfortunately enough, was selected to carry out planning of the experiment. Unfortunately enough, I say therefore that it was a nightmare to do that thing. We had, the government gave us four different possibilities to evaluate, and pretty soon we realized that full basic income is impossible, because the tax rate that would be collected on top of money coming on top of basic income would be something like 70-80%, and it had been too much, and it had been very costly. Then negative income tax, it's not the proper basic income, therefore it was rolled out like other models, for example, that Atkinsonian participatory income. And therefore, the thing that was left was partial basic income. And the level was something we thought in the very beginning, something like 550, 600 euro a net a month. And then what was very interesting, and I don't know if it's interesting from the Brexit point of view, but it was interesting in the Finnish point of view, because we are still members, member in the European community, and the European community has very much to say what is happening in member states. And when we were planning the experiment, one question was that what on earth the European legislation will say if we have this and that kind of system. So if it's a portable benefit or not. And because, as I said, in Finland, everything is based on residence. In that case, that was a very important question. It's not citizens-based, but based on residency. And therefore, we thought that, okay, that red line that's indicated here, vertical, horizontal red line, it implicates that if the benefit is bigger than that, in that case, the European Union comes and say that, sorry, guys, you can't do that. But if the level is lower than that line, in that case, we can do nationally what we want. And we had lots of micro-simulations behind there, and there was, in the morning session, nice presentations about the possibilities and impossibilities what can be done with the micro-simulations, and we did lots of them. We delivered something like 500 pages, different kind of calculations to the government when we then ended up a certain kind of model. And in the very beginning, we had an idea that we'll have different levels of basic income and different levels of taxes that are linked to those different levels of benefits, and therefore we had been able to evaluate what's the importance of the level and what's the impact of taxes. And we had an idea that we will have something like 10,000 persons included in this study, and there will be a nationwide random sampling plus local experiments to get a kind of interaction effects that in the local experiments we will get. But then what came out from the political process was that it was only one level, 560 euros on net a month, and present taxation that will come on top of that. And it's obligatory, legally obligatory participation, and it's 2,000 persons that are included in the experiment. And because it's legally obligatory, our constitutional committee of the parliament said that nobody, you can't have that kind of experiment where somebody will lose. You can't compel people to participate in something where people will lose. And therefore, we had to plan that kind of system that is win-win for everybody. And that's one flip side of our experiment. But what I'm satisfied is that it's obligatory. There's no selection bias whatsoever, and up to now, the experiment has been running 1.5 years. Only 50 persons have quitted or opted out. One reason is, or there are natural reasons, invalidity, pension, or death. Otherwise, people are still included in the experiment. And what I'm also satisfied with the experiment is that we have that treatment group getting that basic income, and then we have a control group, identical control group. And therefore, in the end of the experiment, we can just compare means, and if there are differences in means, then we can conclude that the differences are caused by the treatment, this 560 euros that we are paying out. And then we are collecting lots of registers, and the good thing in my employer social insurance institution is that we have registers almost on everything. We have registers on housing benefits, child benefits, sickness benefits, pensions, social assistance, etc. And we even have data on which kind of medicines people are eating, which kind of diagnosis they are having, etc., etc. And then from Statistics Finland, we will get the information of their salaries and wages and all incomes. And then we have lots of possibilities to do tricks without going to the people and asking what they are thinking. But of course, we can answer the what question by looking at the registers, but we can't answer the why question. And therefore, we are going to carry out surveys and interviews to ask people why you choose that option. Why didn't you go to work? Why did you go to work? Why did you start your own enterprise, etc., etc.? So that the combination of different approaches give us possibilities to look at the experiment from different sides. And we have some hopes that we can also collaborate with for example, our Dutch and Canadian colleagues, because you are running also a little bit similar experiments, and then we can look at basic income from different angles and get much more reliable data. And as we get in the case that we would only have the Finnish experiment or the Canadian or the Dutch experiments. And also, of course, the Indian, Namibian and Kenyan experiments are included in that hope that we could collaborate.
Thank you, Olli. Thank you. Would you like to put some questions?
Okay. Yeah.
So, as Olli has to leave early, we'll open the floor for questions right now for 5 minutes. So, anyone who's got to ask a question?
Yeah, we do have results in that way that we have data almost on daily basis on social security benefits people are getting. But because we don't have data on income, because income registers in Finland, they are lacking almost 1 year behind. So that the taxation registers for 2017, they will be ready sometimes in October this year. And we have been a little bit cautious to say anything about those social security benefits, because we don't know what are the mechanisms behind there. And also, our government or ministers, they are very eager to know that, could you say something? And I have said that in the case that I speak to you, to ministers, in that case, it's the same if I speak to yellow papers, because next morning everything will be there on the tabloids.
Any other questions? Can I please remind you to say your name and also your professional affiliation for the sake of recording, please?
You very briefly flashed up a slide about the EU regulations that were in some way, I think, limiting the ability of Finland to do as it pleased. I didn't quite catch what those rules were. Perhaps you could briefly rehearse them and in particular explain what the thinking is of the EU and, frankly, why they regard it as their business.
Okay. The explanation is political, because the minister who is responsible for this experiment is coming from the so-called True Finns, and they are, a xenophobic party. And the most important question for the minister was that what will happen if we have this basic income? Will all refugees from Iraq come to Finland? And when they are in Finland, they will call their cousins in Lebanon and say that, please come here. And therefore, we had to, show that all those benefits that were above that red line, they are portable benefits. It means that if a person works in Finland and comes to Finland and has a residency in Finland, in that case that he or she moves away from Finland, in that case, the person can take the benefits with him or her. So that was the EU regulation, and also... the EU has to say, for example, when it comes to social insurances, if they are insurance-based, in that case, they are interested in the system. And for example, when it comes to the Dutch experiment, I think that you don't have any problems with the EU because it's social assistance. And in the case that we had only concentrated on recipients or social assistance, in that case, we had nothing to do with the European Union, but because very much many of those benefits that we are replacing, they are borderline cases vis-à-vis national legislation and the European level legislation.
Okay, there's another question to Rose before. Here.
Donald Fisk. Was the sum of money given to people that were on low incomes? And if not, were there any people during the experiment who took jobs and continued to keep the partial basic income?
We don't know yet. So that I will tell it in October, exactly. If you invite me to tell right. on this
but
place.
Initially, you must know whether it was only given to unemployed people.
They were unemployed people, everybody in the very beginning.
Yeah, right.
And we know that in this experimental group, they have found employment, but we don't know how many in the control group have found the employment. So that the next step is to compare those two groups.
Hi, Robert Bruce. If Finland was to consider implementing a full basic income, would this trial answer all the questions needed to do that? And if not, what kind of trial do you think would be needed beyond this before you could take a step that big?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. My answer is that it's a political question, and it very much depends which kind of government the next government will be in Finland in 1 year's time. We will have a new...
I guess my question is less whether you would do it in Finland, but what kind of trials should we be trying to advance if we want to make this happen?
In the case that we had 10,000 persons included in the experiment and all kind of persons, not only unemployed persons, because now we can't evaluate and study the so-called substitution effect. If somebody is employed and she gets 560 euros, will she reduce labor supply or not? We can't study that. But we can study if this has some kind of kicking effect that people will accept short-term jobs and perhaps low-paid jobs much more than in the present social security system that we have.
If there is any final questions before Oli goes. Yes, please.
My name is Anne Gray. I'm a visiting researcher at South Bank University. Thank you. I just wonder if any of your sample who got the basic income created any kind of jealousy amongst those who didn't. Is there an issue about people feeling deprived because they were not in the sample, or about people trying to move house or something to get into the sample?
Yeah, in the Nordic countries, we always invite each other. So that regardless if somebody is getting basic income or not. Of course, if you read social media, in that case, there are lots of discussion that what waste of money. It's totally stupid to give money in their way, and why not me, or why not my wife, or why not my cousin? So that and then because we did random sampling, there are lots of discussion that it's a fake it. So that the answer simply is yes, but perhaps not that much as I had expected.
Okay, thank you very much, Oli.
Thanks.
Thank you. We shall now continue with the rest of the afternoon as we have planned in our program. I will introduce the speakers, and they have been very good at sitting one after the other in the row of the way they are going to speak. So we've got the first speaker, Dr. Sarath Davala from India Network for Basic Income, who will be talking on the transformative and emancipatory potential of basic income, evidence from Indian pilot study, followed later by Professor Evelyn Fauger from the University of Manitoba, who will be talking on the Mincom project and Ontario Big Experiment. Then we have Dr. Dirk Harman from Basic Income Grant Coalition Big Pilot Project in Namibia to be speaking on Turning Money Upside Down, Lessons and Challenges of the Big Pilot in Namibia. Then we have our final speaker for the first part of the afternoon, who is Dr. Michael Cook from GiveDirectly, who will be talking on testing a new universal basic income in Kenya. So we'll start with Sarath, please.
Okay, good afternoon, and thank you very much for this opportunity. Thank you, Malcolm. Thank you, Ida, for the opportunity to share our story. I know it's a four-year study, and to compress that in 10 minutes is quite daunting. But I was trying to bargain with Ida that can you allocate time according to the population of our countries? But I think that seemed to not worked with her. Nonetheless, what I plan to do is to quickly rush through slides and then so that we can have more time at the time of discussion. Now, basic income is a big idea, but I think the starting point always is the context, as someone pointed out in the morning. So each context, each country is coming to it from its own starting point. So our starting point is poverty and poverty discussion in the country. Can you hear me? So for us, basic income discussion itself is coming from the poverty discussion and the strategies of eradicating poverty, because poverty in India is like an elephant sitting in the drawing room and you can't think of basic income outside that register. So I'll straight away plunge into, this is where we did the experiment in between 2011, Madhya Pradesh and the center, to 14. These are the basic features of the model that we think it almost coincides with what Malcolm presented in the morning. It's universal within the village, which means the richest and the poorest, everybody got it, unconditional, individual, monthly, and it was cash and not commodity or any other way of transferring. There were actually two pilots. One was for 17 months. We extended it for 5 more months because and increased the amount. Whereas the one was the tribal village is single village and for 12 months continuously. So the amount we transferred was roughly 3.3 pounds per adult and half of it per month. And these are some figures about the number of people involved. About 6,000 people got, individuals got, and 1,113 households, and that's the amount of money we. Each household got, I think that's a critical thing, the net amount each household received in the tribal village was 15,000 rupees, and in the caste village, that is 16,000 rupees. The reason why we split this into two pilots is, these are the caste villages, 8 villages were caste villages where normal caste system existed, and one is the tribal village. The state where we were working on this was where the state government said, we were talking to the government said that, why don't you take a tribal village so that in just in case the behavior of the tribal population is different. So that's how we added one more pilot. So we had a baseline, midline, and endline, and it was called a modified random control trial, which means we had a control village and the village where we gave the money. We had a qualitative track where we have tracked families across 2 years to see what exactly the behavioral changes were happening in the families and also in the community. So here we have this archive of 100 case studies. So I'll quickly run to the 7 top results. Now, I am presenting the top results of the tribal study because I just want to give you a snapshot of what kind of trends in the findings. All this is in the public domain. Anybody who wants to know more, they can always access the entire report. The book is there, and the data is also open source. Now, myth falsified that the first thing people say about that they will drink it away. No, I think it has shown, we'll see in the actual data also. Then the basic income allowed people to shift from more exploitative forms of employment to slightly less exploitative or benign forms of employment. So they could make a choice, we could see the choice. They could plan better and they acquired new small assets and made unproductive assets more productive. And they ate better, the food sufficiency improved a lot, and more diversified food. In terms of debt was one of the most important finding, that the borrowing behavior also changed, that people shifted from the money lenders to relatives. Not completely, but there was a shift towards getting borrowing money from softer loans. And this is very important. The sixth one is that what basic income does to the mind is far, far more important than the amount of money that is involved. That it tackles what is called, what we all understand as income insecurity, and it brings a certain amount of security. With that, I think quite a lot of things happen in their own planning and in their own perspective. And
people with chronic illnesses, I think the healthcare behavior also has, we could see improvement in it. So the point, important point is that why I'm using a pompous word called emancipation is that you could see that it's not just about getting money and consuming, but it does something psychologically and in the community, and it has that sense that people want to get out of oppressive living conditions to better conditions. You could see the shift. I wish we could run this pilot like Kenya is doing for 10 years, but we just could do only for 12 months. But we could see. So I'm giving you snapshots of some of the data. You could see in this, the food intake, the red line is the where we gave basic income, and the blue is where we did not. You could see alcohol coming down. You could see consumption of oil going up. So you could see the diversity of food, fish and meat. So there was a change over a period of 12 months. And this was a very visible change in the village, that livestock increased so quite substantially, that with small amounts of money, people could actually put together money and buy a goat or a buffalo. So which actually is an asset, which is a very productive asset. This is an important thing about that. In this village, people were part doing their wage labor in other farms and cultivating their own land. So mostly they had very small patches of land, so they didn't have capital, didn't have money, investment, they wouldn't cultivate. So when they had this liquidity, they actually, more and more people wanted to cultivate. And you could see that when we asked at the beginning of the study that what is your basic occupation, they called themselves predominantly wage laborers. But by the end of the study, they called themselves predominantly farmers, that own cultivation they're doing. So they cultivate more. What am I doing? Okay. So this is about the reduced dependence on money lenders. Regularity of medicines. I mean, like, a small behavioral thing is that when you have a chronic illness like hypertension or diabetes or things like that, when your doctor says that you have to take this medicine continuously, it also depends whether you have cash to buy the medicine or not. So when you have this liquidity, you know that you have to take this medicine. So that compliance to what they are supposed to do slightly improved, particularly with senior citizens. These are the various changes we saw at the village level, that quite a lot of things, new things started happening. I won't go into each of them. That new fishermen cooperative started. You can see, actually, there are videos on our website. You can see many of these things. We have made short films. New shops have come. So some of the people who were particularly positively impacted are the disabled people. The whole question of unpaid work and underpaid work, basic income somehow, in our view, addresses that question in terms of rewarding care work, and elderly were most important. So 4 years later, we went back again to see which of the positive impacts has sustained, which have not. So this is the momentum effect is the what actually the effects that continued the momentum. Persistence effect is partially sustained, and these are the dropback. If you see there, increased livestock, increased incomes, and improved women's role in decision-making and declining in the use of alcohol. So the conclusion is that people, when they have something to do, they don't take to alcohol, even if they have surplus money. I don't know if it's the same in England, but at least in the village that we studied, partially sustained, so better news. So here you can see food intake behavior, healthcare behavior, and positive attitude at school. So some of these things have partially sustained, but these have gone back. But for example, debt bondage, people where they kind of mortgage their own body for a whole year to a brick kiln owner, that kind of thing, they went back. Children who went from public schools, which are very badly managed, to private schools, they all went back to the public school, which is a very sad thing to after the. So I just conclude by saying that these are the four generic registers in which I can see our results fitting in, that first physical well-being effect, living conditions effect in terms of employment choices and assets, social solidarity effect, we don't have time to go into that, but what happens at the community level and at the, we always underestimate the capacity of the basic income, what it can do to social solidarity. In the morning we talked about the European level solidarity, citizen solidarity, and the psychological effect, that's psychological, what does it do? I know when I got my scholarship to study my research course, the kind of sense of security I felt. So a poor man, you can imagine what it does to his mind. I think there's also even research has not been done much on that aspect of what basic income unconditionality does to the mind. So it is indeed, in my view, transformative and emancipatory. You can access our data, you can case studies and films, and everything is online, free, and open source. Please get in touch if you want anything more, know more about our study. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarath, very much. Your proposal to have the speaking time according to size of population is very interesting, but it will give me only a second to speak. So it wouldn't work on my case.
In your case, Albania.
We'll continue with the second speaker. The third, sorry. Professor Evelyn Fauger.
Thank you. I want to talk to you today about an experiment that took place in Canada a long time ago, in the 1970s. But I want to do that not just for historical reasons, but because it sort of set the stage for the discussion of basic income that's occurring in Canada today and the basis for the Ontario's experiment we heard a little bit about this morning. I should say before I begin that neither the Ontario experiment nor the Mincome experiment were basic income experiments in the way we've talked about it this morning. They're negative income tax experiments. And I want to set the context a little bit for the Mincome experiment before I start talking about results. The discussion about this experiment took place in the mid-1970s, between 1974 and 1979. And this was a period when women were just entering the labor force in North America in large numbers. There was a relatively simple income assistance landscape in place. We didn't have then, and we still virtually don't have any benefits for working people in Canada today. There's no working income supplement. Many social programs were being expanded during the period. The money actually flowed in Mincome for 3 years, between 1975 and 1978. This was one of the five negative income tax experiments that took place in North America during that period. It was cost-shared by the federal and by the provincial government. And it had a very simple purpose. All anybody cared about was whether those louts were going to quit their jobs. What effect will a basic income have on the labor market? Will people work fewer hours? Will they quit their jobs? The design, it took place in the province of Manitoba, and there were three sites in Manitoba. The first was a standard randomized control trial in an urban center in Winnipeg. For families with a head less than 58 years old. The second site, and the one I'm going to talk about, was the town of Dauphin, which was a population, which had a population of about 10,000 people. And Dauphin was a really interesting example because it was the only example in any of these negative income tax experiments of a saturation site. That is, everyone in town over 18 years of age was eligible to participate. Now, remember, it's a negative income tax experiment, so it was universal in the sense that it was universally available, but you only got money if your income was low enough to qualify. There was a third site, and this was an attempt to create a control for the town of Dauphin. So these were dispersed rural towns where people didn't actually receive money, but they completed surveys. The overall sample size in Winnipeg was 1,300 individuals or families. Dauphin had about 10,000 people and about 20% of the population collected over the time period. Families received money for 3 years in Dauphin. The base rate was slightly above the general welfare payment, and just to give you a clue of how restrictive that was, it was called Mother's Allowance at the time. If you were a young man who needed benefits in the town of Dauphin, you were likely to get a bus ticket to Winnipeg and a strong urge to find a job when you got there. The benefit was taxed back at 50 cents for every dollar you earned. So if you went out and got a job, the marginal tax rate was 50%. It was free of income tax. In Winnipeg, it was a more complex design. They had 7 different payout and tax back rates. So what happened to the project? Well, the families were paid, the data was collected, and then the provincial government fell in 1976, midway through the experiment. The project lost political support, kind of limped along. They needed more money. They didn't get more money. Federal government was a minority, and it was sort of hanging on by its fingernails. And it was the 1970s. There were a couple of oil price shocks. Inflation spiked. Interest rates hit about 20%, and middle-class families were claiming they were losing their houses because they couldn't pay their mortgage. And suddenly, poverty took a back seat. So the experiment unfolded. The families got paid. And the researchers, for some reason, decided to dig their heels in at this point and declare they were not going to do the analysis unless they got more money to pay for it. And so what happened? The government told them to archive the data. It would be taken care of later, analyzed later. And so it never produced any kind of a final report. About 15 years later, a couple labor market economists found the labor market data and tried to answer the original question. And they discovered that there was virtually no impact on the work effort for primary earners, but there were 2 groups of people who had a more pronounced effect. Married women. Married women reduced their work effort, and they did it in an interesting way. This was a period when the guaranteed maternity leave was about 4 weeks. And it turned out that some women decided to use their benefit to buy themselves longer parental leaves when they gave birth. So times out of the labor force increased for women. And the other group that had a really big reaction seemed to play into everybody's stereotype. These were young, unattached males. Young, unattached males worked a lot less. So about 20 years later, I was kind of interested in basic income, and I wondered what the effect would be on things like quality of life. And in particular, I went looking for all those young, unattached males. And so I tracked them down. I interviewed them. I was interested in quality of life, education. I was interested in health, especially mental health outcomes. And one of the things I was able to do was to use administrative data that we heard Ollie talk a little bit about in the context of Finland. I was very fortunate because Canada had introduced universal health insurance just before this began. But the first thing I did was to look at high school attendance rates. And if you look at that diagram, this light blue line where you see a nice little bubble in the middle there, exactly coincident with the income years, represents Dauphin. So I pretty much found all those young unattached males. They were in high school. And when I went and interviewed some of them, what I found was that young men from low-income families were under a lot of family, had been before the project started, under a lot of family pressure to become self-supporting as quickly as they could. So they turned 16, the law said they could quit school, they quit school, they found a job, and the world unfolded. Mincom came along, and suddenly some of those families decided that they could support their sons in high school just a little bit longer. And so some of those kids continued, some of them graduated and went on to college, to university. And I just invite you to think about the difference in life chances for a young man in 1975 who finished high school relative to somebody who didn't. The other thing I was really interested in, and a lot of finance people in Canada were really interested in, were health outcomes. So I looked at the administrative data, and I discovered a reduction in hospitalization rates in Dauphin of 8.5% over the period relative to a matched control group. So 8.5%. I mean, I'm not sure how much the National Health Service pays on hospitals in the UK. But in Canada, we're paying something like $60 billion a year for hospitals. The primary reasons, when I started looking at codes to find out why hospitalizations declined, the 2 big ones were fewer accident and injury hospitalization, many fewer child accidents, for example, and in particular, fewer hospitalizations due to mental health. I found the same pattern when I looked at physician contacts. The only thing that showed up as statistically significant were fewer mental health contacts, so fewer people complaining of depression, fewer people claiming anxiety. Now, why do we care about all of that? Well, I just want to take you to Ontario. Ontario's just begun a basic income pilot. Now, we heard Malcolm say this morning he wished they'd called it something else because it's not really basic income. I can tell you there are a lot of supporters of this scheme in Canada who also wish they'd have called it something else because basic income's a hard sell in the context of Canada. This is a negative income tax. They've just begun a three-year experiment with three sites in Ontario. So they have an urbanized center, an urban center in Hamilton with 1,000 subjects and 1,000 controls, a northern resource-based economy in Thunder Bay with 1,000 subjects and 1,000 controls, and a third site in the town of Lindsay. It's really a sort of a small town. And the idea was to replicate the Dauphin experience, to create a sort of a saturation site in that period. There's also ongoing discussion with First Nations. There's hope to run a pilot on a reserve, but that has a lot of political dimensions that have taken some time to get through. And let me just end with a question about how they're going to know if the experiment worked in Ontario. One of the things that they were very intrigued by was the health dimension, the quality of life dimension. So the questions they're asking in the Ontario case are much broader than in the case of Mincom 40 years ago. It is primarily a poverty reduction program. So one of the things they're looking at, of course, is poverty reduction, food security, and all those related measures. There are a number of measures related to health, community, and individual and family health outcomes. They're looking at things like perceptions of citizenship and inclusion, community impacts, and they also hope to look at administrative costs and impacts on other social programs, although it's very limited to the extent to which you can do that in a pilot. The data collected involves both survey data and, to the extent possible, administrative data. Thank you.
Thank you, Evelyn. Dirk.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to present the basic income grant pilot from Namibia. In the first part, I want to focus on the results of the pilot, and in the second part, I'll try to look at the challenges to move from a pilot to political implementation, which have been far less shiny and in fact sad, but I hope the challenges from Namibia can provide useful lessons for those who want to see a true bottom-up approach. And Johannes Sebib, the boy in the picture, has shown what it means to turn the world of money upside down. Oops. Sorry, this is still the old presentation. So I'll I added some notes on the pilot, and I'll run you through just verbally. At the time when the Big Coalition decided to start a pilot, the idea of piloting a basic income grant seemed questionable also to many among those who supported in general the idea of a basic income grant. At the Bien conference in 2006, our group were called the butt kickers, but encouraged through the success of pilots in introducing ARVs in Africa elsewhere, the coalition decided to have a pilot on the basic income grant. And some of the academics also joined in. What we have is a two-year pilot period from 2008 to 2009, paying €10 for every person. There were no additional interventions, no conditions, no training. Right from the beginning, we had an international advisory group to guarantee the standard of the evaluation. This included Professor Nicolie Netris, who teaches at the University of Cape Town and Yale, Mike Sampson from Williams College in the US, and Guy Standing from SOAS here in London. So they worked with the data themselves as well. Then we registered a village and the complete village, 1,000 people. So what data do we have? We have compiled a questionnaire to capture household data individual data, including income data and expenditure data, the sample size being 400 out of the 1,000. And we have a time series, baseline, 6 months, 12 months. We have, in addition to that, to the household survey, we got data from the government clinic. We got weight and height per age of the children and the attendance and financial records of the clinic. Same thing from the school. We got their statistics on enrollment, the pass rate, and we organized with them a drawing competition at the end of the basic income grant where the children drew examples of what changed in their lives. Very powerful. And then from the police, again, baseline, 6 months, 12 months, the crime statistics. In addition, we have got qualitative data. We have case studies for which we used mother tongue speakers and translators later on. And we have an elaborate photo archive and a project diary. And I think what was crucial for the analysis is that all the statistics are recorded in starter programs, so they are reproducible and could be rerun by the international group who were checking on the results. And we had an exit strategy. So what was the life like before the basic income grant? And I just want to give you one quote which encapsulates how the situation was. Wilhelmina Gavisa said, "I and my three children depend on my unemployment parents for food, accommodation. Sometimes I wish I was dead because I cannot stand this type of life anymore. I'm supposed to provide and protect my children and parents, but I'm failing to do that." So what was the life like for Wilhelmina and others when they got the unconditional basic income grant? And the most important finding was certainly that on malnutrition. We got the clinic data, and at baseline, 42% of children under 5 were severely malnourished on WHO standards. So this dropped to, after 6 months, to 17%, and after 12 months, down to 10%. But people did not only spend their money on consumption, but also on productive economic activity, like, for example, Frida Nimboya, who started her bakery small in the beginning, but she was able to extend it and build her own bakery. Or Joseph Ganep, who started to produce bricks, and the quality was so good that the farmers around him started to buy from him instead of in Windhoek. So what we saw is that the income levels, the adult equivalent income, rose from 200 to 389 Namibian dollars, with a payout being 100 Namibian dollars, which shows that people were able to realize an increase in their incomes beyond the value of the basic income grant. A considerable amount of the money stayed in the community, boosting local economic growth. Another important result was that the school reported that for the first time they failed like a proper school. Parents paid school fees, children wore school uniforms, and they did not come there just for the school feeding scheme, but actually could concentrate at school. You can read about all of that in a full discussion in the two reports produced. They've been now translated into Turkish, even into Japanese. They have been circulating around. Let me jump to the slide in the beginning, because I want to come to the reaction, besides the publicity, to the pilot nationally and internationally. The idea of somebody giving money directly to people for nothing drives some people on or over the edge. One morning, a couple of months into the project, we got a phone call from a senior person at the World Bank, and she said, "We hear in Washington, hear so much about the project in Otjiwero. Is it really true that you're giving money to a whole community without conditions?" And in that situation, we could not help to be reminded of the cartoon Asterix and Obelix in the last village in the Roman Empire, where a 10 euro payout per month to 1,000 people disturbs the peace of mind of people in Washington. And this was funny, maybe in this peculiar response, but others were quite hostile right from the beginning. And I want to just highlight one now because of the time. The one by the IMF. The IMF started to intervene, and they advised the Ministry of Finance in Namibia against the basic income grant. They provided calculations which they then had to admit were wrong. They then did not retract their calculations and openly said, we are not worried about a billion more or less, a billion being 100 million pounds or less in the budget, but they do not support the principle, and that certainly has been damaging. And some peculiarities were even more personal. For example, my wife Claudia and I were once called into the German embassy in Namibia and were told that they could make sure that we would no longer get a development aid worker contract if we continued to work for the basic income grant campaign. But the crux of the matter lies with the Namibian government in the end. So initially they even claimed ownership because the proposal came initially from a cabinet tax commission. But when the IMF started to intervene, they turned against the basic income grant. What the pilot has managed to do is to challenge government and still challenges government. It has grown to the biggest civil society at that time, coalition against or for a policy after independence. And there was a dramatic twist 3 years ago. Our chairperson of the Basic Income Grant Coalition, Bishop Zephania Kameta, became the first minister of poverty alleviation, directly appointed by the president. So, clearly because of his profile as chairperson of the BIC, and one might take this as a sign of success of the pilot. Bishop Kameta told us that he's going to introduce the basic income grant within months, and even before his appointment was made public, we were part of a small group who prepared a cabinet submission for a national rollout. We thought we are that close. And we managed to get the financing, everything calculated, 5 to 6% of the national budget, well within reach of Namibia. But once he was appointed, the public announcement got postponed. His ministry has started a food bank, modeled on the UK example the president had seen in Britain, and Kameta has withdrawn from public statements on the basic income grant nearly altogether. The coalition has tried to keep in touch with him, but has slowly but surely disintegrated, and most of them have lost hope. It could still be done, but now I think it would take a lot of courage and some tough choices to introduce a basic income grant in Namibia anytime soon. So just to sum up the lessons, there are rights. There's the right of the child, there are rights for education, there is the right to basic health. But in a monetarized society, you need money. There should be a right to a basic income. And I do not think that we need more experiments to show what it can do to poor people. It frees them out of a struggling economy, out of struggling for daily life. This is clear. This has been shown in Namibia. You heard about India. In a completely different context, we have shown the Indian results in Namibia, and people said that's exactly how we felt. So if you need a control group to believe a study, it's all there, it's in the Indian case, or go to the website of GiveDirectly, you can read what people have to say themselves who are receiving a basic income grant. My concern is more, how do we get from a pilot to implementation? And there are some sad lessons from Namibia on what can go wrong. I think one needs to reckon with some crude interventions and opposition defending vested interests, and that includes political appointments. And I think we need to reorganize also the basic income grant movement according to the principles of solidarity, anti-hierarchical, people-centered, voluntarism, and transparency in line with the basic income grant principles in order to manage to implement a national basic income grant. I thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dirk. Michael.
Hello, so I'm Michael Cook. I'm the research director at GiveDirectly, and I had the very great privilege to spend my working days doing what, as Dirk said, to spend my working days thinking about, talking about, reading about, and planning research about an idea that, drives some people over the edge, which is giving money to poor people, no strings attached. And so our research is all about seeing what happens when you do that. So I'm going to take you on a quick whistle-stop tour of what GiveDirectly does as an organisation, and then spend most of the time talking about our work piloting and testing a universal basic income in Kenya. So what GiveDirectly does is pretty simple. We find very poor people in three countries, mostly in Kenya, Uganda, and in Rwanda, and we send them cash transfers through mobile money. So these are cash grants, they're not loans. Our most common way of doing this is to send people $1,000 per household in a series of two or three payments, which is not what we're doing for universal basic income. We'll come on to that later. But because it's pretty simple, and the advent of mobile money as a technology has massively reduced the transactional costs of doing this, we're able to do it pretty efficiently. So what this 90% efficiency number means in practice is that for every $100 we spend on a program, $90 of that ends up in the mobile money wallets of one of our recipient households. Research is something that GiveDirectly as an organization and me as an individual, I hold very dear. And so we are constantly doing what I think are pretty big, high quality studies to try to understand what the impact is of giving money to people, no strings attached, but also to find out the best way of doing this. So I'll talk to you in a minute about the general evidence base around cash transfers in low and middle income countries. And it's pretty solid that this does a range of good things for people. But what we really want to find out is what is the best way of doing this? How can we deliver the most, the biggest gains for people who we are working with? The point of this slide is not to look directly at any of the text, which will be minutely small, even for me standing here. The point here is that when we're talking about giving money to people in the developing world, this isn't a kind of situation of kind of dueling or competing like assumptions about, well, I think it will do this or I think it will do that. An awful lot of research has been done. So this picks out some of the different studies that have happened. To pick out one, there was a study in Uganda which gave grants of just under $400 to young people and found that 4 years later their incomes were 40% higher than a control group. And there's lots of different studies that have found kind of different benefits in different contexts, as you would expect, because people are facing different barriers. But the Overseas Development Institute published a massive tome, a 300-page review of 165 different high-quality studies. So this is an area in which an awful lot of research has been done. We've heard quite a lot today about some of the worries about what happens when you give cash to people unconditionally. And again, this is an area in which a lot of empirical research has been done. So Abhijit Banerjee wrote this wonderful summary of seven very high quality studies that looked at the impact of giving cash transfers to people on their work effort and found that there's no evidence that these kinds of cash transfers reduce work. There's an even bigger study covering 19 different high-quality studies looking at how much people spend on temptation goods like tobacco and alcohol. Again, that found that it didn't increase spending on those things, and if anything, might reduce it slightly. And when we've looked at the impact of GiveDirectly transfers, we found a very, very similar finding. So get lots of good stuff, people's earnings go up, the assets they hold go up. So a bit like with the experience in India, that's kind of things like livestock, but also people improve their housing, so they might replace a thatched roof if they have one with an iron roof that costs less to maintain and is better at keeping the rain out. People spend more on food, and also people's psychological well-being improves. So these are measures like depression, stress, happiness, and life satisfaction all improve. And again, we found no impact on people spending on things that people worry about. And so on to what we're really here for today, which is what we're doing to test a universal basic income. So I think this probably ticks quite a lot of the yellow book boxes in terms of what a basic income would be. So it is universal. So every individual adult in the villages that are eligible for, and I'll come on to that more about the research in a second, but every adult in these villages will receive transfers from GiveDirectly. It's basic in that it's sized to cover people's basic needs. It's long term, so some of the villages will be receiving transfers for as long as 12 years, and it's unconditional. And this is something that I found very interesting in the talks this morning. I'm used to thinking about the difference between conditional and unconditional being not about what makes you eligible for a program, not whether it matters whether you're employed or unemployed or a man or a woman. I think of that in terms of eligibility. I think of conditionality in terms of, particularly in Latin America, a lot of the cash transfer programs, people have to fulfill conditions on an ongoing basis. So the continued receipt of cash transfers is dependent on them sending their kids to school or attending health clinic visits are the most common ones. But anyway, so I was very relieved that both by the definition I thought I meant and the yellow book, that these are unconditional cash transfers. And we're testing UBI in two ways. One, I think, is similar to some of what we've heard about through some of these presentations about on a kind of fairly small scale basis, looking at what it involves for us as an organisation to deliver a universal basic income to a village. So there's a one village pilot where we started working about 18 months ago, which has enabled us to kind of finesse our operations for doing this at scale, but also to get some qualitative feedback, which I'll tell you about shortly. And the second way we're testing a universal basic income is to do a pretty massive research study. So this is a large randomized control trial testing different types of cash transfers and the impact that those have on people. So this is our research design, led by this stellar cast of academics on the right, with the actual survey fieldwork delivered by and research logistics delivered by Innovations for Poverty Action. So this is all being done by an independent team. There are four different arms to the trial. So there is a group of just over 40 villages who will receive payments of the equivalent of about 75 US cents a day for 12 years in monthly payments. There'll be a group who receive the same amount, but only for 2 years. And so we'll be able to look at what difference does it make having the certainty that payments will continue a long time into the future. There's also a group who will receive roughly the equivalent of what the middle, the equivalent of what these guys will receive, but in a big one-off lump sum payment, as we call it, to look at the different impact you might get. You might have different choices about how you invest money if you have a kind of $500 up front versus that amount spread out over 2 years. And then importantly, a big control group to see what would happen, what happens to people in similar villages who don't receive transfers. I'm not going to go into this too much because I think this is very similar to what you're showing about Ontario. Cash transfers can affect people in all kinds of different ways because people face all kinds of different barriers in their lives, and so we need to look over a big wide range of ways that this could affect people at an individual level and the way it could affect the communities that they live in. And so, as I said, we've been working in a pilot village in Western Kenya for just over 18 months. This is fairly typical of the villages in the study. And we've been asking people kind of anecdotally, how is this affecting your decisions about work? And, you know, this is only a few people. We need to wait for the results of the randomized controlled trial to have good measures of this. But what people are saying is pretty much in line with what we've seen in other cash transfer studies in places like Kenya, that people want to work either the same amount or more. But for some people, and a bit like with the Ontario example, that there might be people for whom work really isn't what they want to be doing. And so if you're really elderly or disabled, then maybe you don't want to be doing physical work, and it enables people to step back from that. And there's more, as I got a nice intro from Dirk, there's more of this on the website. There's a few different blogs writing up what people have told us from the pilot village. And then I just wanted to leave you with some examples of what people have said that they've spent some of their first payments on. So I'll leave this up, but I think this is gives us some idea of some of the kinds of findings that we might be looking for when we come to analyse the study data further down the track. So people are spending this on a range of things. They might be spending on medical expenses or on, you know, their small businesses or on school fees or on food for their families. There's a whole range of people. There's a whole range of uses that people put this to, because it's our belief that the recipients who we work with know best how to improve their lives, and that's why unconditional cash transfers are what we're all about. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Michael, and thank you to all of panelists. We now are going to address, we've got roughly 20 minutes to address some of the questions or comments from the audience. Please keep your questions or statements short for a chance to get answered. Please say your name and professional affiliation for the sake of recording. Thank you. Right, so I've got one question there and one question the lady in the end.
Okay. Hi, thank you for all those interesting presentations. My name is Amanda Hill Dixon, and I'm a senior researcher at the Young Foundation. We're currently doing some research as part of the BEAM Income experiment in Barcelona, and we're responsible for the qualitative ethnographic research. And I just wondered if I'm finding the kind of lighter touch anecdotal qualitative findings here very interesting. I'm just wondering if you're aware of any kind of more in-depth qualitative research that's been done as part of any basic income trials, and if so, what we can learn from them, and what might be questions that you might want to ask and answer through a kind of more in-depth qualitative approach. Thanks.
Your question was to the whole panel or to someone?
Yeah, to anybody on the panel.
And we've got the lady in the end, yes.
Hi, I'm KU from Belvix College. I'm a lower sixth former. I have some interest, curiosity about the psychological impact it might have on those villagers. For example, at first, how could you make them believe it's not a trick or fraud, and what are their reactions in facing those trials? And lastly, after they receive them, when you withdraw those basic income from them, would there be loss aversion reactions, and would that have any negative impacts? Thank you.
Okay. Can take two more questions. Got the gentleman there. And there.
Just based on Daniele Caprera, just based on what you discussed now, I'm just thinking, is basic income good only for poor country? And other question I have is, how much the local government contributed in the scheme that you guys have shown us? Thank you.
Okay, and the gentleman here.
Good for poor people. How could we construct a pilot whereby rich people who are being asked to give money through higher taxes, they will see the benefits, and how can we find out whether they will start to approve of it? but that's a difficult pilot to run, I suspect.
Okay. Can we decide which one would you like to start?
Maybe with the last one?
Okay.
Yeah, that would be a difficult pilot, but I'm reminded of an example of a professor of mine in South Africa, and he discussed a basic income grant with bankers in South Africa. And in the end, they were convinced that a basic income grant is needed because they also realized the effects of inequality to society and realized that if a basic income grant was there and people got out of precarious situations, it would be beneficial to them and their clients as well.
Yeah, coming to qualitative data, I think both Namibian and Kenyan experiment and our experiment, I think there's tons and tons of qualitative data available. We have kept everything online. If you can access all the 100 case studies that we have, village profiles and lots of other stuff about community. And I think these days you have lots of films, Kenyan film, I think you have Uganda films. So I think you have access to that. The psychological part, when we initially went to the villages with this idea, I think there was a sense of disbelief. And the rich farmers, many of them actually, they kept themselves out of the study and also the experiment. They said that we will not participate. About 10% of the population of the village, the entire households. But then 3 months later, the women of those households came back and said that we would like to participate in this. Our husbands may not want to because we want bank accounts to be open for us. We want to participate in the meetings that all the women in the village are sitting in. So that's how eventually even the men came into the... Because I think initial suspicion was that we are going to take their signatures and then take away their lands and things like that. The other important thing about psychological thing, I think about the effects that we talked about, that psychologically what it does to people when there is a sense of security over a period of at least 1 year or 2 years, then you, I think, quite a lot of positive things happen. When it was stopped, were they hostile? No, we still go back. I think, as I said, we went back after 4 years to see what exactly sustained. I think people were not hostile to us. Is it only poor country that require? I think this is really a million-dollar question the entire BN is actually confronting with, because I think it has its relevance because you have different classes and basic income has relevance to different classes in different registers. So we are, particularly in India, we are talking about poverty. I think even Michael is talking about poverty. Even Namibia, those are the top issues. But I think there are other equally important issues in European countries and North American countries as well. And I don't think one should make a hierarchical thing about where is it more relevant and less relevant. Government contributed. How much government has contributed? For our experiment, we partnered with the government in the sense we tried to bring in the government into our experiment. But I think there is tremendous illiteracy about what it means, because till the end of the experiment, government bureaucrats and ministers kept on asking, but why are you doing this? Why are you giving free money? Why can't you, if you want to do research, why can't you come and help us with improving our own some of the programs? What exactly do you want? And they were so hostile to us. But then they participated. But then 1 year later, after our study, after the Swiss referendum, suddenly government started talking about universal basic income. And all those years when we were talking, they said it is a useless concept. Now, government of India itself brought out a perspective document on this. With that, I stop.
I think the question on people's reactions and whether you would think it was a trick or a fraud is a really interesting one. And I try to imagine how I would react if someone just pitched up randomly at my door and said, hi, I'm from some random NGO. I'm going to give you the equivalent of your household income. You don't have to do anything. Sign here. And I think that it's quite natural to be sceptical about these things. GiveDirectly's field teams have, you know, put a huge amount of time and effort to engaging with government at a kind of regional level, in Kenya, at a location level, at a sub-location level, with village elders. We run big village-wide events called Barazas to introduce people to the program. And so I think because we do that very, you know, put a lot of effort into that, most of the time the reactions are extremely positive. There are some times in some of our other programs where rumors have circulated about why we're doing this, and our experience is that once those rumors start, it's quite difficult to persuade people otherwise, and we've kind of written blogs about this in the past. But yeah, overall, people's reactions are usually extremely positive, but we don't kind of take that for granted.
Yes, I'm Clive Lord, and I'm afraid I've got to start with a little bit of an ego trip. I actually thought of the basic income before I had any idea that anybody else had invented it. And I did so because I was almost a founding member of the Green Party. I met the original Green Party had been formed in response to the Limits to the Growth study, which said that if economic growth went on as it then was in 1970, 1972, we would be heading for trouble. So I joined the Green Party and said, look, you're talking about a recession. Oh, no, we won't call it a recession. We'll call it a planned economy or something positive. I said, it'll feel like a recession. What are you going to do when people are desperate? And they said, if we have to, martial law. If you've got a better idea, you'd better come back with it. Well, I did come back with it. Now, that is where my starting point as a Green Party member. My main reason for the basic income was to deal with climate change and all the ecological destruction. I am not hearing that mentioned by anybody in the basic income movement, and that is really beginning to worry me. Now, I have a specific question to ask. Incidentally, in the developed world, which is, Manitoba and so on, it's different from Britain, but the point is, it's quite simple. You've got the poverty, you've got means testing. All you've got to do is get rid of means testing, and I don't see why people get worried about it. However, I have a specific question for Drs. Hartman and Cook. There are two reasons why we're destroying the planet. One is economic activity. The other is increasing population. Now, my ideal would be to see that every woman in the third world had the same opportunity, same confidence that her first two children would survive that women in Britain have. Now, am I worrying unnecessarily? To what extent do you two, I'd like your you two people are on the ground, am I worrying unnecessary? What do you say about
you,
it?
Okay, your question, shall we take a couple more? Yeah? So we've got the lady there, and we had the lady there as well.
So I grew up in America and came to England sometime around the mid-80s and was completely shocked by the social security system. But in the years that I lived here, I realized there were so many benefits to the social security system. This lack of competition and less crime, far less crime, far less of an aggressive culture. So when speaking to, I understand extreme neoliberalism that you have when you grow up in the U.S. There's a phobia about communism, and that comes from our history, the McCarthy era. But I find the best argument that works is to appeal to brute selfishness by pointing out that crime, there's a direct correlation between crime and inequality. And so if you see paying a little bit extra as a bit of a crime tax, and that argument works so well, because I say if you pay a little bit extra, if you're willing to pay a little bit extra to alleviate poverty, crime will, as sure as the sun will rise in the morning, will go down. And I get staunch.
I'm afraid we can't have long statements.
Oh, so I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Yes, okay.
Please.
Sorry, okay.
Do you have a question for the panel or statement?
No, I just wanted to make
that
point.
Thank you, I'm
sorry. That it's a good sale to come at that angle.
Thanks Cheers. Very much. Got the lady there and the lady there, please.
Hi, my name is Isolyn. I'm a student of social policy. My question is, so I see that there is actually, in the Namibian case, there is actually competition with other social security programs. So one question is, like, what were the social security programs available before before the basic income was introduced in, for example, in India, Namibia, in Kenya? I think it would be interesting to compare.
Again, the next question over there, please.
Thank you very much. First of all, thank you for all the presentation. Second, I appreciate that there are more women represented on the panel in the afternoon than in the morning. And thirdly, I was quite concerned about his stories of being harassed, intimidated on a high level, including by the diplomatic people. My name is Zulfiya. I work for Amnesty International, and obviously I'm concerned about harassing people who work on something useful. And I would like to talk more and question to the panel if you have experience or know about stories where people working on trial of basic income, any pressure from any side. I would love to know about it more. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your comment. And actually, as a testing of a research, I was when I was taking the questions, I was basing the selection hoping that there will be women, female members of the audience who would ask the first questions, because research shows that men ask 2.5 times more than women in Q&A sessions. So the way to avoid the gender bias is by taking the first few questions from women, which I was very happy to see today. Thank you. So who would like to start first from the panel?
I can start. So... To come to first to the question about the environment, as I think you're alluding to, that the more certainty people have that their children will survive, generally the fewer children they will have. And so, you know, what one of the things we want to find out is, with this study, what will the impact of a universal basic income be on health for adults in the village, but also health for children in the village, particularly in terms of things like malnutrition. And so that, you know, that's something that we're going to find out through the study. But what we know from the other literature is that very often cash transfers improve a range of things which would lead to children dying. So people have better health, they have better nutrition, better food security, and so on. The question about crime, again, this is something that we want to look at. It's a really interesting question. We'll wait and see what happens. I'd love to know. Kenya does have a range of other social security programs, including cash transfers for families who are looking after orphans and vulnerable children. There's been quite a lot of talk about the extent to which a kind of old age pension scheme would be introduced, and I think it's very likely that that's going to evolve over the 12 years of the programme. But it's what we want to look at is, I guess, the incremental impact of adding on this programme on top of those other programmes. And then I'm not personally aware of any pressure that GiveDirectly have come under, but maybe that's because I'm sat in my ivory tower in London. I'm not the person dealing with various different people in the countries where we deliver our programs.
On the environment, I think I would fully agree, one needs a perspective in life in order to take care of the environment, and therefore economic security is important, I think, in the long run. But of course, in those situations, like in Ojibwe or India, what we want to see is economic growth, and that would also result in more economic activity and possibly more CO2. But I think useful and good economic growth, and it needs to be scaled down here. Your question about the increase in fertility, all the evidence I have seen is that the more people are economically secure, the fertility decreases. One would need stronger or longer-term studies, but I think that that is pretty clear across the globe. On your question about what programs were there before, there have been in Namibia the old age pensions universally, very successful. Often families live off the old age pensions and disability grants to some extent. The proposal in Namibia was not to alter the old age pensions, but only to pay the basic income grant up until pensionable age, and then they would move on to the higher old age pension. In terms of intimidation on different levels from the farming community around there up to the secret police which stood in front of our house and greeted our children. But I think in a way the secret police wasn't that secretive. So it it showed also that it challenged government. And I think in that way also a good thing.
I'd just like to comment on the crime comment, if I can. It may be a uniquely North American phenomenon, but I find exactly the same thing. I mean, when I put that slide up about an 8.5% reduction in hospitalizations, people start calculating. And about 50% of the budget of most provinces is going to provide health care. And then they start asking questions, well, what about crime? Well, I didn't have the data. But the reality is we know that in almost all cases, poverty exacerbates almost any the costs associated with almost any social program. When I work with low-income mothers, it usually takes about 5 minutes before somebody worries about, mentions the fact that they're constantly worried about having their kids taken into care, having their kids end up in the foster care system. And one of the things I'd dearly love to get my hands on is that data to find out whether or not a basic income actually is good for family stability. And that's particularly an important issue in the Canadian context because so many of the kids are First Nations kids, Indigenous kids.
Sorry, we have to continue with
talk to you later.
You can continue your conversations over the coffee break.
I guess the other comment is about the context of other social programs, and I think it's really, really important to recognize that people are coming from different places. Context is so dramatically important. It is virtually impossible to sell the idea of a citizen's basic income in North America, but they understand a negative income tax. And, even if you look at the context of the 1970s, one of the reasons Ontario is replicating an experiment, well, we've had all those trials in the 70s, why do it again? Well, the answer is that the income support network in today is very different than it was in the 1970s. And one of the big issues for the developed world, right, for high-income countries, is how all these different social programs fit together. It's a much simpler case if there aren't any or if there is a very rudimentary system in place. But the more complex your system, the harder the set of questions you have related to all of those various programs and the impact on the on other things. Thank you.
Well, in India, we have our pilot was a top-up of everything. We did not remove anything. We did not exclude anything. It was just a top-up over the existing other programs that we have in India which have come up into the discussion. One of the largest food security programs in the world is in India. We call it public distribution system, where there is a general consensus among our scholars and the government that there is 42% of leakages, but it still continues. But the governments and the bureaucrats are very, very fond of commodity transfers. They give blankets, they distribute bicycles, they distribute saris, they distribute you name it, it's there. So each village will have about 250 schemes of a variety of commodity transfers. Now the question is that, is it desirable? Should governments be transferring commodities and grains and all that?
The whole question is government capable of doing it efficiently at all? That's a big question we are asking. We are not saying that we should replace a public distribution system with a basic income. But if it comes to it, I would rather bank on basic income rather than on only public distribution system. Now, we didn't run into that problem. The hostility part is that at the time when we were doing our experiment, there was also a bill in the parliament on right to food. So there were some activists of right to food people. They were under the impression that we were conducting this experiment only to smash the bill. So they sent some people to our villages where we were doing studies, study and writing about them to find out anything contrary to what we were writing. So such things happened, but I think that did not make much of a difference to us. On environment, I don't think I can say anything on crime also, but the only issue is very important issue is what liquidity at the household level does to an ultra-poor family. Ultra-poor families, mostly they don't have cash. They don't deal with cash at all. Most of the time, they are in debt. They move from one debt to another. So in a household like that, when you inject cash, it does many, many more things. Particularly when you said that the first child should survive, second child should survive, and they should have that confidence that my child will survive. I think we saw that when you have that liquidity, the healthcare behavior changes. The healthcare seeking definitely improves than otherwise. So to have that access to cash is extremely important because it is so, so expensive to borrow it from a moneylender. Thank you.
Thank you to all of the panelists today for sharing their fascinating findings from the research that has been going on and also for undercovering the politics of implementing universal basic income. I hope the stories of Secret Service and IMF calls and everything has not scared the speakers of the next panel who are about to embark into this research. So we will now break for 25 minutes, so be back here at 4 o'clock, please. We're starting sharp at 4 o'clock with the next panel. Thank you.